Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by the Rebeller Podcast Network. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, editor-in-chief of Rebeller. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell.
Glad to be here. Love talking about movies with you guys every week. It's so much fun.
So much fun. Before we get started, I'd like to discuss Rebeller's first book, They Called Me Wyatt, by Natasha Tynes. You might remember the story of Natasha Tynes, the author who lost her book deal after Twitter's outrage mobs canceled her for tweeting a photo of a Metro employee eating on a train. After she lost her book deal, Dallas Sanier reached out and rescued her novel from the ash heap of history. If there's anything Rebeller stands for, it's saying no to the perpetually aggrieved. That flamethrower at the start of each show is wielded by Dallas and aimed right at the heart of phony outrage. They Called Me Wyatt is available now in paperback and on Kindle at Amazon.com and via ebook from Google. All right, first up in controversies and non-troversies, Apple is partnering with Paramount to bring Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon to everybody's theaters. That's right, it's going to be in theaters. It's not going to be on a streamer. There was some talk about Netflix picking up the tab for this $150 to $200 million version of David Grand's book, which is about murders in the Osage County of a group of Native Americans who had stumbled onto oil and become fabulously wealthy. This is, I think, good news for a variety of reasons. Paramount and Apple can actually put this thing in theaters. And if there's anything we know, it is that theaters are extremely popular right now and important, and everyone's going to them. So we got to have stuff in them. But seriously, I was worried that this would go to straight to Netflix as The Irishman did. And I was worried that this would be yet another signal that theaters are passé and moving into dinosaur territory. So I was glad to hear it, but you know, there is still some controversy about the cost of this movie. Alyssa, as you put it to me, there's no way this movie should cost $150 to $200 million as a story to tell. What do you make of this price tag?
I actually nominated this for controversies and non-controversies because it seems to me like an example of budget bloat at a time when the entertainment industry, for its own survival, needs to consider some leaner movies. And I don't know if any of you have read Killers of the Flower Moon, which is quite good, as everything David Grand writes is, but there is no justification for this costing as much as a Marvel movie to make. It is a completely human story. It's not even told over decades the way The Irishman is. So there's no need to age up and people up and down dramatically. There is, you know, you need some period clothes, but you don't need special effects. It's an entirely human scale murder mystery that is going to cost this much money, presumably because that's what it takes to get Leonardo DiCaprio like away from his supermodels for a while. It's completely ludicrous. I mean, you know, you can make this and have it look as good as something like Hell or High Water for just vastly less money. And I adore Martin Scorsese. I liked The Irishman a lot. I think he is a giant of American cinema culture. This just feels crazy to me. And I'm sure I'm reasonably confident I will like this movie. I actually am pretty over DiCaprio, who I think is just always acting. But this just feels so crazy pants to me that I, as much as I want to see it, as much as I think the movie will probably be good, it just feels like a symbol of something that is really off. And it bugged me. I wanted to talk to you guys about it.
I am pretty open to giving Martin Scorsese most anything he wants, in terms of budget and all that. And I am sure he has his reasons for needing this sort of money. I mean, Peter, what would you say that just the cast and crew alone on a picture like this is going to cost?
Well, it can cost almost any amount. You can spend as much as you want, or in some, depending on how you do it, as little as you want. But there are trade-offs when you do that. I think it's interesting that we're talking about this on the same week that we are also talking about The Vast of Night, a micro-budget movie that was released on Amazon Prime. And I don't know what the budget was on it, but it can't have been more than a couple of million. I wouldn't even be surprised if it was done for under seven figures. And it's a movie that, as we're going to talk about, shows you what you can do with a very tiny budget and how good you can make a movie look. On the other hand, when you are talking about these really big productions like Scorsese mounts, with big stars, with huge casts, with all of the fixins of a major studio production, especially if you're doing it on location, which you presume that this would be done. What you're really talking about is building a miniature pop-up luxury city, because you've got dozens, if not hundreds, of people who you have to fly out to the middle of nowhere. And many of them are reasonably well paid, if not exceptionally well paid, professionals who have to be kept comfortable. And you've got to basically build a city on location for at least a couple of months, if not for closer to a year. And so that's why a film like this is, in some ways, the comp for this isn't The Irishman, it's The Revenant, which the budget was somewhere in the range of $125 to $150 million. Starred Leonardo DiCaprio. It doesn't look like a big effects picture. On the other hand, we know that bear sequence was a big effects sequence, and there's a lot of digital work that goes into that. But it's also just a huge, huge undertaking to bring the big crew that is necessary to produce a movie like this out to the middle of nowhere, keep them fed and happy, and also to kind of create the amount to give a director the level of control that someone like Martin Scorsese expects. And so if you're doing it on a super tiny budget, then what you end up doing is having a kid ride a go-kart with a camera attached to it to get your one long shot, and you've got one take to make it work, and if it doesn't work that night, you're screwed. But if you've got Martin Scorsese, if you've got one of these other big directors, then those guys are just going to be able to spend a couple of weeks often just to get one single shot right. A couple of weeks, a couple of months to build the sets and get everything set up. And that's, I don't know, on the one hand, it's totally wasteful and bloated and unnecessary. On the other hand, as someone who loves big, ambitious movies, I actually kind of love that. I love the idea of taking resources like that, putting them all on screen. I do think the thing we have to talk about, though, are just the actor salaries and the kind of
right.
above the...
Like, what percentage of this is, you know, is DiCaprio and De Niro, both of whom...
And Scorsese. Between the three of them, the reports are that...
And Jennifer Lawrence is in this, right? Is she not?
It's possible. I don't recall hearing that, but I'm... I don't have it in front of me. The reports I've seen is that just those three look like about $50 to $60 million in costs. And so if it's a $150 million movie, $180 million movie, then you're looking at nearly a third of the budget being just getting those three on board. On the other hand, all that extra $100 million in spending, which employs a lot of people who make good money but not insane money, doesn't happen unless you have DiCaprio and Scorsese working together. Those are the people who make it possible for everyone else to have their jobs. And so there is a kind of a justification in that those guys are the money makers.
One instant clarification. Jennifer Lawrence is starring in a movie with Leonardo DiCaprio that Adam McKay is directing. So that's where I got my signals crossed there. No Jennifer Lawrence in this movie.
But also, I mean, to a certain extent, I agree with you, Peter. But also, there is no chance, at least in the short term, that this movie is going to be made under the circumstances that you describe. The pandemic just means that is impossible. I mean, this movie is going to be a movie made under those conditions on location with a production of that scale is going to be uninsurable. It will not even be made for that amount of money because the safety and health precautions will be so onerous and everything will take so much more time. Maybe in 5 years this movie will be made under the conditions you describe, but I don't think that's actually a realistic scenario for something shooting like in 6 months or next year.
I guess I haven't seen any reporting on this, but knowing how much Scorsese expects from his productions, how just what he is able to get studios to finance in terms of giant build-outs of sets and in terms of taking big crews on location, knowing his just incredibly high expectations for the production of his films, do you think that he is going to change his plans that he certainly had to shoot this on a location and find some way to make this in a big warehouse in Atlanta somewhere? I think if that's his option, he just doesn't make the movie. He waits it out.
Well, and that's part of why this feels just all sorts of absurd to me. Like, I don't think it is going to be possible. I've been spending a lot of time reading about just the insurance issues involved in making movies, because when the pandemic hit this spring, some productions and studios were able to get insurance payouts because their insurance writers didn't include specific carve-outs that would have excluded shutdowns due to a pandemic. But COVID-19 is now, you know, considered a known risk, right? So even if it declines during the summer, you know, and then ramps up in the fall, and people took the decline during the summer as proof of something permanent rather than something temporary, you will not be able to get insurance coverage for a production shutdown, which means that, you know, if you are Paramount and Apple and you have paid out $70 million to set up production and the movie gets shut down, you cannot recoup any money to cover either the movie never getting finished at all because people go off to other commitments, or just the money that you have to pay people to keep the crew together until they can start work again. Yeah. And so,
Can we just give people a quick primer on like what insurance actually is meant to cover in situations like this? Because I know it's something that I am aware of and you guys are aware of, but listener.
If you want to do the primer, go ahead. I mean, like, basically it's, you know, like with any business, it's supposed to be a safety net under you if your business is shut down for reasons beyond your control.
Right. So if your star like breaks his ankle or something and you have to shut shooting down for 2 weeks, you still have to pay everybody on the set for that 2 weeks. And, you know, these are all union deals. They're all union workers. So they have like guarantees where if you are stuck on a set, but you aren't doing any work, you're still getting the money for it. So a shutdown of a month can cost, you know, $1 million a day, easy.
And so it's sort of like a step in between, you know, the unemployment insurance that workers might file for from the government. This is sort of insurance against that insurance, right? It's, you know, it's something that the studios and the, you know, the like the production is paying for specifically to kind of prevent everyone from scattering to the four winds. It's like a stopgap measure, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's insurance against the fact that they just have to spend a lot of money. And if they end up, and if there is a freak event, in particular, stars being hurt or worse, in some cases, you know, losing their lives, being unavailable for some freak reason, or losing a set. So this has happened a couple of times on Waterworld. They actually had to rebuild the big floating city set completely from scratch because a hurricane took it out, and that was like $4 million. So stuff like that is what insurance is for, just because these are huge productions. And if something happens, then you're just sort of stuck with you've spent all of this money and maybe you don't even have a movie at all. Who knows? I do think the insurance costs are a real issue. But again, do either of you think that Martin Scorsese eventually decides to make maybe not a cut rate in terms of dollars spent version, but a cut rate version, a version that doesn't live up to his ambitions, that doesn't fulfill what he believes this movie should be and needs to be? This is a guy who has spent years trying to get this into production and at one point had pushed the budget up to estimation up to $220 million. It's now come down a little bit from that. And that's because that's how Martin Scorsese thinks about movies. That's what he thinks they should be, especially these days. Do you think that if he is told we can't insure this and we can't and pandemic precautions mean that you're going to have to shoot this on a closed set in a little box somewhere, and it's basically going to be a Marvel movie against a green screen, except realistic, you know, Scorsese film? What do you think he's going to do? I think he's going to say, I'm not making that movie until we can do this the right way.
You know what? I think it was interesting. Someone on Twitter had posted a letter that he wrote that Martin Scorsese wrote to the New York Times, I think back in 1993, responding to a kind of harsh piece the Times ran shortly after Fellini died. That was about sort of a tax on foreign cinema and the insistence that cinema all be the same way. And so we're talking a lot on this podcast about the way that Scorsese thinks movies should be. But rather than, you know, putting him in rather than putting him in this rigid box, I would love to see Martin Scorsese make a $50 million version of this movie. You know, I would love to see him not necessarily make it on a green screen, but like, you know, spend some of that money on Gil Birmingham or one of the other great, you know, not huge name, but really good Native American actors who, you know, could never sell a movie like this at $220 or $150 million, but who, you know, could play characters who deserve to be an important part of the story and just do it at a smaller scale. You know, it is as deadening to cinema to say that Martin Scorsese can only make movies one way as to suggest that he will never make a movie that way again.
But I'm not suggesting he makes that he only makes gigantic movies. What I'm saying is when he has a particular vision for a movie, he tends to think that that is the only way that that movie can be made. And so he has made, Silence was made for about $50 million if I recall correctly.
Yeah.
He has made small movies. He spent his formative years making relatively small films. But when he believes a movie requires a giant budget, he has been a stickler for that and has gained a reputation, amongst the studios as somebody who just demands that they shell out huge amounts so that he can fulfill his vision to see it correct, to see it done correctly. And I just can't see him saying, well, I guess for a movie that, let's be honest, any movie he makes might be his last. He kind of knows that, that he's going to say, just kind of take a mulligan and be like, well, I'll do this not the way that I think it should be done.
Yeah,
we're kind of you guys are kind of talking past each other. I mean, I understand both what Alyssa and what Peter you guys are both saying. Alyssa, you want the movie regardless. Like you just want to see it. You want to see that story. And Peter says, you know, Martin Scorsese says he can only do it one way, so he should be allowed to do it that way.
I mean, I guess given that I don't think movies are going to be made on that scale for a long time, it would be exciting and I think encouraging to a lot of people in the entertainment industry to see Scorsese pivot and work within a different set of constraints, right? I mean, if he could, we all revere him because he is, you know, so humane and has demonstrated, you know, just, he's one of the last people who can make sort of human stories and get them greenlit and, you know, make these movies that connect with us on a different level. And, you know, we're at a moment where the entertainment industry can go down a couple of different paths, right? It can dramatically shrink the number of movies that it makes, have them all be sure things. Or it may end up just making a lot of small, quickly shot things. And, you know, the idea, I'm sure this is all in Scorsese's head. I'm sure he has a really good pitch that would convince me about why this has to be a $150, $200 million movie. But if the choice is between not having the movie at all and having a version of it that's different, that proves that those human scale stories can survive, I want the smaller version of it because I want all of the other movies that follow from that.
I totally agree. I would rather have a Scorsese movie than not have a Scorsese movie, for sure. But I do think it's, I don't know whether I quite want to say it's justified, because what in the world is justified? But as somebody who loves watching movies, I like seeing directors get just massive canvases to work on. And Scorsese is somebody who has proven that he actually knows how to use a big budget, how to use, you know, big stars in a way that other folks don't always, and I would love to see him, towards the end of what is definitely going to be towards the end of his career here, just get an opportunity to kind of take a really big swing at least one more time.
So what do we think? Controversy or non-controversy that this movie is moving to Paramount / Apple at that budget?
I mean, I'm the one who nominated it. I ultimately think it's a kind of a non-controversy, and it's my feelings about it are just an expression of my profound existential dread over the state of the movie business.
I don't think it's a controversy that the budget is where it is. I do think it's a controversy that it's moving, and that what that tells us is that Netflix is no longer just shelling out any amount to get stuff, and that this is changing the economics.
We actually don't know that's true, though. I mean, how do we know that Scorsese? How do we know that Netflix didn't offer up $200 million and then Scorsese took that to Apple and Paramount and said, "You guys can put it on theaters, right?"
I guess that's possible, but there were reports for months here, even before the pandemic, that Scorsese was pushing the budget past where the studios were comfortable when this deal was at Netflix, and that Netflix was getting cold feet because they just saw the budget here expanding.
This was never at Netflix. This was never at Netflix. It was at Paramount.
Apologies.
And my understanding is also that Paramount...
But also that it does tell you something, that Netflix didn't end up being the ones to buy this, right? After buying $200 million worth of Scorsese before. Excuse me.
Yeah, but I'm just saying that we don't know that they didn't make an equal offer and that Scorsese didn't say no. Anyway. I think it's mostly a controversy, and I also believe that Scorsese has earned the right to kind of, you know, set his own terms here. If that means the movie never gets made, that's unfortunate, but you know, as Peter says, he is winding down here, and I don't think he wants to, you know, cut his vision in order just to get it made. So be it. All right, we are moving on to The Vast of Night, a very small movie. This movie did not cost $200 million to make. It is on Prime Video now, debuted on Friday, May 29th. It's set in a small New Mexico town in the 1950s. It is about two teenagers, I think. I'm not 100% sure on the ages here, but two teens, one of whom still seems to be in school, one of whom is all done and working at a local AM radio station. They, in the course of one night in this New Mexico town, come across a mysterious sound. It comes in through the radio airwaves, and it comes in through the phone line that the young woman, her name is Faye, works at, played by Sierra McCormick. Jake Horowitz, who plays Everett, is the radio guy, and he's filled with hip 50s patois. He's jiving and manning and, you know, daddy-o and all around town. this is the first movie from director Andrew Patterson, and it is on the one hand a very self-assured debut. It calls to mind a movie like Donnie Darko, where there are lots of different camera things going on, and kind of similarly to Donnie Darko, you get the sense that the director is doing a lot of things that he's always kind of wanted to do with a camera, and that is good and bad. I mean, I'll be honest, I found this movie slightly distracting insofar as I could feel the direction all the time as the camera is swooping around and moving around a gym and then out into the street and all around the city. And I can understand the artistic reasons for this, trying to create a sense of space and a sense of isolation and all of that stuff. You know, you have the whole town essentially in one room for a basketball game, which is kind of where the thing starts, and then you move around to other emptier parts to get a sense of the vastness of the night. I gotta be honest, it didn't entirely work for me. It didn't entirely work for me for reasons that I think Peter got at a bit in his review up at Reason. The mystery at the heart of it feels very, I don't know if we want to put it this way exactly, but J.J. Abrams-esque. There is a mystery. The solution to it is, I would say, unsatisfying. And whether or not that is intentional and designed to frustrate viewers on purpose, I don't know. It did me. But on the other hand, it is also it's a pretty well-written two-hander. The two young actors here are very good and very good with each other. There's a real chemistry there. And it is pretty gripping despite its small scale. Peter, please tell me if I have done you an injustice with my little side note on your take on the mystery box aspects of all this.
I mean, certainly not an injustice like what Zack Snyder did to Watchmen, but no, you're basically right. I liked this movie. I didn't quite love it. It is a very good movie, a very promising movie that also kind of shows the limitations of the low budget sort of streaming format and the movie era that we are in which that is the only kind of movie. And so I went into this having known that there were a bunch of good reviews, didn't read them because I didn't want to spoil too much, but just looked and said the reception has been quite strong. Like you, I found it quite gripping. It's just very technically masterful. This is somebody who really knows how to direct a movie, how to use the tools of movie making, even at a very small budget, to tell a story. I just didn't find the actual story all that involving. It just kind of, it basically announces where it's going to go, and then goes there. But what it does is it stops in some really interesting places along the way, and it just sort of has these moments that you if you sort of think of the story as a journey, they're like scenic overlooks, and we just sort of stop and admire the view from where we are at the moment. And so it's a movie that kind of doesn't fully come together at the end, and I think I maybe my expectations were a little bit too high going in particular because I was really hoping to see like an actually great, like this is a classic that I really want to come back to kind of movie. And instead what I saw was a really promising debut from somebody who really knows how to direct a movie, but still probably has some things to learn about how to control and tell a story and what types of stories he wants to tell. So in this moment we're in which there isn't the regular pipeline of big studio movies, though. When you see one of these films that is kind of an interesting, you know, like a cinephile curiosity that's getting great reviews and it's like, oh, this is a buzzy little thing. Normally that would just be like the kind of thing that we talk about as an aside. But now it just sort of carries all of this weight of expectations and it just kind of doesn't quite live up to them. At the same time, taken on its own terms, it's really a quite well-made film, quite engaging, and shows a lot of promise, gives me hope for good movies to come.
Alyssa, I felt kind of the same way as Peter did. And again, I didn't read any of the reviews. I just looked at the RT score. I was like, oh, 95-96%. This is getting really, really great reviews. And watched it and mostly came away thinking, okay, this feels like COVID inflation. Cause it does feel like it feels like an actual real movie, which is a big, big plus in its favor, but
feels like a real movie. Quote going in on the poster.
It's, you know, you hold this up to Capone and you're like, one's a real movie, one's not quite there. But at the same time, it's a streaming movie. And even if it's a very good streaming movie, and I think this is probably above average as far as streaming movies go, it is still kind of slight. Am I wrong here? Are we wrong? Have we underestimated this?
I don't know that you've underestimated it. It's interesting to me, though, Peter, that you've ended up talking a lot about the sort of the technical competence of the movie, which I would note, like some of the Lee Whannell movies that we've discussed on the podcast earlier this year, is very well scored and sound edited. But it's also, you know, the director, Andrew Patterson, also just gets four really nice performances out of what are effectively four leads, one of whom you never see on screen. And, you know, Jake Horowitz, who plays Everett, the radio DJ, and Sierra McCormick, who plays Faye, the switchboard operator, who he ends up sort of hanging out with over the course of an evening, have just a really nice chemistry. But he also does a good job of, you know, showing how... getting performances out of them that show how patter can become revealing over time, right? I mean, that opening scene that starts the movie is talking in a way that, you know, is a little, I will admit, I found a little off-putting initially, but you can see how they're both trying to kind of impress each other in various ways. And it ends up in a sort of series of revelations about both of them wanting to leave town, having sort of different scales of ambition, you know, Faye saying that she'd love to go to college, but that just doesn't seem like something that's possible at all. And, you know,
he talks about how you have to go to LA if you want to be in radio, because that's where all the big things are happening.
Right. And so you know, it's the script is the script, and the script, I think, is pretty strong in the interplay between the two of them. But Patterson just gets a really nice kind of joint rhythm out of those two actors. And then what really impressed me about the movie, and the point at which I felt like it kind of calmed down some from that early visual and actorly hecticness, was after Everett puts out this call on the radio to see if anyone has heard a sound like this before. And you get essentially two companion monologues. They're not quite monologues, but you have two different people telling Everett and Faye about their experiences with this noise. And Bruce Davis in particular, as Billy, the black soldier who calls in to recount his experience being sort of drawn into this mission that clearly kind of destroyed the lives of the people who participated in it. It's a great performance apart because you never see his face, right? It's just really outstanding voice work. And the movie just, you know, all of the action falls away. In some cases, even sort of the visuals fall away. And you're just sort of listening to him tell this incredibly sad story that takes some of its melancholy from it being a story not just about aliens or about soldiers, but about soldiers who were considered sort of disposable and not credible because they were black. And, you know, that is material that can be done well or poorly. And here it's written well, but it's also just performed really nicely. It's not low key. It's very low key. You know, the performance is not sort of histrionic or keyed up. And then Patterson does it again with Gail Cronauer, who plays Mabel Blanche, this woman who, again, was sort of marginalized for being a single mom, and who does, like, you can see how she seems crazy to people, right? I mean, she's telling the story effectively about her son being in communion with and then kidnapped by aliens. You can see the sort of desperation that's made her, like, the more desperate and convinced she is, the less credible she seems, including to Everett and Faye. And yet Patterson just gets this really profound melancholy out of her. And, you know, one nice performance can be an actor, but four of them in a single movie is a sign of a director who has not just some significant technical prowess, but really can do something quite nice with actors. And so that to me was part of what was.
Yeah, I thought that it's interesting. You point out the Billy's monologue and where the visuals drop out. To me, the boldest visual move in the movie isn't the big swinging camera moves that are super long. It is that at that moment, I think it happens twice, he decides to drop the visuals completely and everything just fades to black with no explanation. But what he's doing is, if you've ever been in a radio booth or on a podcast, sometimes you just kind of just to concentrate on the words, just to focus on what's being said, you close your eyes and you just sort of tune out all the things that you're seeing and you just focus on the words. And he brings that experience directly. He forces it on the viewer. He says, no, I'm going to close your eyes for you and make you just listen to the words and the sound of the voice. And it's really kind of impressive that he pulls it off, because it's a little bit of an audacious thing to do and it could easily have failed.
Yeah, I'll be honest, it didn't entirely work for me, that move in particular, in part because the sound design of this movie is slightly weird. And maybe, you know, maybe this is one of these things where if I'm watching it in a theater with a great sound system and I'm able to like fully concentrate on the screen as opposed to watching it again on my computer off a computer link, you know, a screener link, with all the attendant distractions, you know, in the home with two children running around, etc., that kind of entails, right? Like I have 2 points here. The first is that this is a movie that strongly makes the case for being seen in a theater. I feel like that move in particular, the fading to black and like really enveloping someone in darkness, only works in a dark movie theater. I don't know that works in the midst of day.
I have a couple of friends who saw it in a drive-in and said that was just the perfect environment awesome.
Totally. That sounds great. The other thing is the sound design is a little bit weird on this. And I wasn't sure if it's just, you know, my headphones or what, but when the weird sound that is the heart of the mystery of this thing kind of kicks up, they layer music on top of it, and it wasn't clear to me entirely what was supposed to be diegetic and non-diegetic. I kept struggling with what was like movie music and what was like music in the movie, if that makes sense. And I don't know. Again, this is perhaps, again, a function of watching it at home in a place where there are distractions and focus is less than total. But that in and of itself is kind of a brief for, you know, the primacy of the movie theater experience.
I watched this at home with a surround sound system, like, you know, through my Apple TV, it went into the home theater system. And I will say I did not have those particular issues. The sound design, I don't think was maybe as sharp as something quite like Upgrade, but it was really quite nice. And it actually, it all felt like it made a lot of sense to me.
Well, it's probably just me then. I'm just a bad watcher. All right, what do we think?
Environment and circumstances matter, and the technology that you use to watch and consume and listen to movies matters as well.
Yeah. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on The Vast of Night?
Thumbs up.
Not just thumbs up. This is the movie of the streaming films we've watched. This is the one that I've enjoyed the most.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm going to go.
Come on, Sonny.
Thumbs up. I guess I'll go thumbs up. It's very much a two and a half star movie for me. Like the things I like the things I don't like, and there are a fair number of them I don't really like, but it's fine. Again, grading on the COVID curve. It's a thumbs up, I guess.
But is the COVID curve flattened or not?
I am part of the 96%. I'm the problem 96%. On Rotten Tomatoes. All right. Now on to assigned viewing. Assigned viewing for this week is The Way of the Gun, which is the 2000 film written and directed by Christopher McQuarrie. It was his follow-up to writing and winning an Oscar for The Usual Suspects. It stars Ryan Phillippe and Benicio del Toro as a pair of kidnappers who take a woman who is played by Juliette Lewis, her name's Robin, take her hostage while she is pregnant with the surrogate child of a very wealthy, very bad person. The movie is about the two kidnappers trying to get their money. It's about the very bad person trying to get his baby back. And it's about James Caan, playing an old, broken down, tough man who, if you know anything about him, that he's old and broken down, but still in the game. It's that he can survive. I love this movie a great deal. I find the script work to be very snappy. This is Christopher McQuarrie. Christopher McQuarrie has sat in movie jail for many years after this because it was a pretty big, I wouldn't say it was a huge failure because it was a relatively cheap movie, but it was not an enormous success. And he kind of went about doing script doctoring for many years until he fell in with Tom Cruise and became Tom Cruise's go-to guy. But I love this movie a great deal. I like the performances. It's got a strong Nicky Catt performance. There was this, I mentioned this on Twitter the other day, but there was this moment in like 99, 2000, 2001 where Nicky Catt was in this, The Limey, and the Christopher Nolan movie, Insomnia. And he has these like great little performances where he's like weirdly the best thing in every scene he's in. And I think that goes for here too. But it's also just a really well shot movie. And it shows a lot of, again, we're talking about, you know, a first time director here. It shows a guy who like actually understands how to frame things and how to shoot action and how to use action sequences to up the drama. I mean, the standout sequences in this film are the opening shootout after the kidnapping has taken place, and the final shootout, which takes place in a Mexican whorehouse, where guys are running around hallways like it's a Counter-Strike map, trying to take each other out, and the, you know, reloading at the proper times and using all of that for drama, like actually being able to use a gun reload for drama, is an underrated element of action filmmaking, and it's something that Christopher McQuarrie showed a competence at in this very, very first film. So I like it a great deal. It is certainly a bit more abrasive for some of the people on this podcast. Alyssa, my understanding is you did not care for this, judging by the G-chat conversations that we were having.
So I feel like The Way of the Gun was a big deal for the guys on my high school debate team when it came out.
And... Oh, man, that is a sick burn.
And I thought it was, I put myself through a lot for the guys on that debate team, but I did not put myself through this movie. And almost 20 years later, that decision is validated. I thought this was so dumb. I'm sorry, Sonny, but I thought it was ridiculous. And this is the kind of movie where I could talk about it's like almost total contempt for and ignorance of women, or it's just like weird casual homophobia at the beginning. But I just thought the writing and the pacing of it were ridiculous. I mean, I literally was making a list of sort of pretentious sentences as we went, but like, I would never ask you to trust me. That's the cry of a guilty soul. But trust money? As soon as she lays eyes on him, nature will take over. Like, the only thing you can assume about a broken down old man is that he's a survivor. Okay, that's an okay line. But
those,
like,
are good lines. Those
these
are good
lines.
Aren't, you're crazy.
No one incident makes anybody what they are. Certainty is more important than morality.
Alyssa, I mean, that's how men talk.
Yeah, I don't know what you're... This is. It sounds like you've never actually met a man before. That's what I think.
But, I mean, I'm sorry. Like, so many of those lines are so silly and portentous. Like, that opening scene at the sperm bank is, like... I mean, it's funny to a certain extent. To a certain extent, it's, like, there's something kind of appropriate about the fact that we're watching this movie the week that the provocateur Larry Kramer died because of some of the language and sort of underlying sentiments there. But, like, it's so full of itself. You know, it's hilarious.
It's interesting that you describe those lines as homophobic for those who haven't seen the movie or haven't seen it in a while.
The opening scene of the movie with Sarah Silverman's character, who is literally credited as Raving Bitch, like that's her character's name, right? That scene's definitely homophobic. Like, I mean,
that's homophobic.
Yeah, I mean,
I thought you were going to talk about the sperm bank scene.
No, the sperm
where
bank scene
about
is
like LA as a what does he call it, a mecca of homosexual migration?
No. So what's
but
really,
he's making a point because
he's making a point about the underlying homophobia of the questions that the guy is asking him.
Right.
But the just like super casual use of like anti-gay provocation in the opening scene, like that.
Did you not see as making fun of it?
By the villain of the scene. Yeah, Sarah Silverman, like, is not like the hero of that scene.
But the sort of casual use of it, right? I mean, because like the implication ultimately in the movie is that the characters are not gay. So there's no sort of weight or threat to any of that language. Like, I mean, just to, you know, fine. Like, I'm happy to make the case that this movie is homophobic and misogynist in addition to being bad. Because, I mean, I don't know that either of you... I mean, obviously, neither of you had to deal with a sort of like turn of the century misogyny, but neither of you, I assume, had to deal with what it was like to come out in those particular years. And as someone who was one of the first people in my high school to come out and did deal with a lot of that stuff, just the sort of constant casual anti-gay insults, even if they weren't aimed specifically at gay people, even if they came out of the mouths of people who were inconsequential and who you knew were bad, was exhausting. And like, even now, seeing how dated all of that stuff is, like, even as, you know, a bisexual lady married to a man, like, that kind of constant sort of casual running down of other people's humanity is just exhausting to listen to. And given that in the movie that it is like, again, it's by the villains, it's by people who don't actually have the guts to back it up with actual violence, even though the scene does turn into a brawl. I don't know if either of you can fully appreciate just like how tense hearing that kind of thing can make you feel, even when it's casual, even when it's sort of throwaway, even when the people speaking those lines are like, it's not that language is used by heroic characters or protagonists, because this movie doesn't really have heroes. It's, I mean, even if you put them in the mouths of the villains, what's homophobic about it is the casualness and sort of thoughtlessness of just the use of it, right? As if it's sort of, it's treated as kind of weightless and silly, and it's not silly. It's just, it grinds you down. It's degrading. And it's exhausting to revisit that. I mean, this is also a movie that just has like no idea how women's brains or bodies work at all, but even though that's ostensibly sort of central to the plot, it's also a movie that doesn't actually care about the baby at all. But that's sort of a side note.
Well, the baby's just the MacGuffin.
Yeah, I mean, the baby's the MacGuffin, but it's, I mean, the movie also makes the decision to just treat like the baby's actual safety and like this for all of the plot, and like all the characters express that they care about the safety of the baby. And for all that some of the characters profess to care about Robin, Juliette Lewis's character, the movie just has no sort of thoughtfulness or regard for what it's like to be a woman in that situation at all, in a way that undercuts the MacGuffin, right? I mean, it's, you know, there is a mismatch between the movie's ostensible concerns and the way that, and Ryan Phillippe is terrible in this movie, but the way like his relationship with Juliette Lewis is supposed to sort of reveal something more about his character is totally undercut by the way the movie treats her and her baby. I mean, it's just, it's a decision at odds with the movie's ostensible purpose.
So, I mean, I certainly see, agree that it comes across as dated in certain ways, and that there was a lack of the sort of sensitivity that people would have now in writing a bunch of these scenes. At the same time, I think, you know, if you just in part from reading about the how this movie was developed and where it came from, it's not quite a satire, but it's a little bit of a parody of the kind of movie it is. There's a sort of weird meta self-awareness to it, which is that it is about, it's about this sort of super gruff, uncaring, insensitive masculinity, and sort of, and examining the different ways that that can manifest. And it's sort of telling, if you look at, what McQuarrie has said about developing this film, the initial idea was that, so he'd come off of The Usual Suspects and he figured, oh, I'm going to not have any problems making my next movie. And then he had real problems getting funding to do anything other than work as a script doctor. So he goes to Fox and he says, look, I want to make a movie on any budget level that you will give me. And the only thing I want, like, I'll take the smallest amount of money. The only thing I want is a guarantee of complete creative control. And Fox was like,
didn't he do that after pitching a huge Alexander the Great?
So he was also working on that, like, around the same time. Yeah. And Fox was like, no, here's our offer to you. Nothing. You can keep rewriting our scripts and making them better, but we don't care about your ideas. We only care about you making our ideas better. So he realized, you know, he was going to have to get movies made on his own and try and create a success. And his initial idea for this was to make a movie that in which every character was deeply unlikable, in which every character, in which none of the characters did any of the things that are conventionally required to kind of win an audience's trust, to be what screenwriters will say, to create rootable characters, right, that you want to win. And so this movie in some ways was designed to be a kind of an exploration of the fact that men are around each other all the time, acting in this sort of hyper masculine way, are ugly and gross and awful. And so in some ways your reaction there that they're awful is what he set out to do. In fact, he actually pared it back a little bit. Apparently before the film was shot, the initial version of the script started with, 10-minute sequence in which McQuarrie, this is a quote, the first thing I did was to write a list of every taboo, everything I knew a cowardly executive would refuse to accept from a sympathetic leading man. The first 10 pages were a prologue, a trailer to another movie with Parker and Longbow, and was to be shot as slick and as hip as possible, kind of Guy Ritchie, Michael Bay style, but with horrible, unspeakable acts of violence and degradation. The idea was to put off people. And the movie that's left is clearly still sort of hues to that kind of design of like, let's just never have the save the cat moment. Let's not have them be heroic. Let's show that they're kind of awful and that it's telling.
Well, except for
the fact that
James Caan's character, like,
so he gives
totally
it a little bit of a heart at the end, but it's telling that sequence.
He gives it a heart by shooting them in the legs so they'll bleed out on the floor of a Mexican whorehouse's bottle strewn.
So he can go be saloon. So he can go be with his daughter and his granddaughter.
The rule for screenwriters is that you're supposed to typically you want to end the first sequence, the first, like the prologue of a movie with the big idea that the movie is about. And what's that? What's the last line in that opening bit? You want to do the man dance, right? That's what this movie is. The movie is you want to do the man dance. And then the rest, the next hour and 45 minutes, the next 2 hours are a bunch of guys doing the man dance. And it is kind of
stupid. The man dance is
kind of ridiculous.
I mean, this version of the man dance is stupid, right? This is the movie where, you know, every man who complains about romantic comedies, like, oh, it's not for me, I shouldn't have to be dragged through this. Like, this is the equivalent of that, except it's worse written and worse acted than many excellent romantic comedies. I mean,
There's no way this is worse written than The Lovebirds last week. Come on.
Okay, but that's not what I'm comparing it to. Like, I mean, the idea that...
Well, it's a rom-com.
The idea that people would you know, slit their wrists over being forced to watch a Nora Ephron written romantic comedy and be like, oh, this is cinema. Like, that's just, I mean, that's not like, you know, this is like, as the like token lady, the person who like, you know, who has the annoying like wussy views about stuff. Like, I'm sorry, your movie is.
You said it.
Yeah.
You said it.
I'm sorry. Like, this movie is ridiculous.
Nora Ephron never wrote a line like, a heart is the only thing that has value. If you have one, get rid of it.
Or I think a plan's just a list of things that aren't going to happen.
There's always free cheese in a mousetrap.
Always free cheese. There's so many good lines in this. I don't understand. I don't understand Alyssa's problem.
It's
frankly.
Also just like, can we talk about how awful Ryan Phillippe is in this? And basically everything except Breach. McQuarrie may have wanted full creative control on this, but he also basically just gave in when Ryan Phillippe insisted on being cast in it. And Phillippe is terrible. I mean, his voice is not as crazy as Tom Hardy's voice in Capone, but it's like, it's ridiculously affected. He's either dramatic or like completely, you know, personality-less. He's just, he can't act. He shouldn't be an actor. He should find another profession.
Is he an actor anymore?
I have never.
What happened?
I have never quite understood if he is doing an accent there or if he is just marble mouthed. Like it's not entirely clear to me what he's doing there, which is ironic because he's like playing, you know, next to Benicio del Toro, who like played the mushed mouth character in The Usual Suspects,
who is definitionally marble mouthed. Yeah,
and Benicio del Toro though was great in this movie. I love him in this. I love James Caan in it.
Yeah, James Caan is great. James Caan is
the guy. The guy who plays Abner. Jeffrey Lewis, who was also in my favorite Clint Eastwood Western, High Plains Drifter, is also very good in this. He's the guy who is tailing them and gets I don't know. And again, Nikki Catt, I don't know. I love this movie. You're wrong, Alyssa. You're wrong. Your opinions are wrong on this.
I think Alyssa's opinions about this movie are kind of right, but she's also describing some of the things I kind of enjoy about it. It is a ridiculous man dance of a movie. It's totally over the top. It's totally affected. And
yeah. It's not an Italian neorealist masterpiece. It's the equivalent of a noir or a hard boiled.
But it's also very soap opera-y in the way that it goes about that stuff. And yeah. You know,
so there's, I don't think either of you watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine, but there's a scene in the first season where one of the characters is undercover as, like, she's pretending to be pregnant. And the ruse drops and, like, the pillow that's under her shirt gets, like, shoved off to the side. And she, in an attempt to salvage the ruse, like, clutches the pillow. It's like, oh, no, my baby! It's like... That's Juliette Lewis in this movie, right? And it's like, I don't think she's, you know, she's fine in some scenes, but it's like, it's a movie that has just no idea about like pregnant women's bodies at all, right?
There was definitely a moment from like 1992 to about 2000 where Juliette Lewis was in many things, and I was never 100% sure why. she's okay, but like, I don't know. It's never from Cape Fear on, almost.
Yeah, and just like the ridiculous scene where the trophy wife is like, oh, there's an ultrasound video. I'm a mother now. Like, this is not how women work. Like, you know, and it's it's fine, but don't ask me to take it seriously, right? Like, I am fine with there being sort of dumb, not particularly good movies that are aimed at people of different genders. But the idea that the gender of people who are just, like, characterized and sort of treated with, like, total contempt in those movies should be required to take them seriously, I think is just deeply silly. So to all the guys on my high school debate team who love The Way of the Gun, you're wrong. I'm sorry.
Wow. Like, here's Alyssa being wrong again on the podcast. All right. Assigned viewing for next week is Dirty Harry. That's courtesy of Alyssa. I guess she likes some good movies. I don't know. Hard to say. Which is currently streaming on Amazon Prime, I believe. Or is it on Amazon Prime or Netflix?
It's on. You have to rent it on Amazon Prime.
But you have to rent it on
but
Amazon.
But you can also buy it for like $5, and you should buy it. Yeah. It's good.
I have it on Blu-ray somewhere in my garage currently. Ironically, the lockdown has not allowed me to clean anything out because I don't have any bookshelves. All right, that's it for today's show. Please make sure to check out They Called Me Wyatt by Natasha Tynes, available at Amazon.com. Please go to RebellerMedia.com and sign up for a membership. If you don't sign up, we don't get to keep doing this. And remember, for the next 2 months, it's free. Just click on that little box at the top of the homepage. If you love the show, tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. And if we don't grow, we'll die. And review us at Apple, unless you're a big fan of The Way of the Gun. Maybe wait till next week. If you didn't love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sunny Bunch. I will convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.
Across the Movie Aisle is a Rebeller Podcast Network original, hosted by Sunny Bunch, Alyssa Rosenberg, and Peter Suderman. Produced by Sunny Bunch and Natasha Pasetta. Executive producer, Dallas Sonier. Associate producer, Jessica Safavamare. Art and design by Jason Koslerich. Sound recording, design, and mixing by Sunny Bunch, with music by James Malone.